New government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulation.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory
activity. $1.8 trillion.
That's how much
business centers and down bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
Our topic this afternoon is a great one. We will be discussing big tech, competition, and antitrust enforcement. This discussion is timely because there is growing concern among some experts and government officials that big tech companies such as Amazon, Google, and Facebook have grown too big and controlling for some smaller competitors to operate in the market. Some have proposed that the government should unwind past anti-competitive mergers. Among many areas today, we will explore governmental oversight of big tech companies and the proper role of the government in promoting consumer welfare and market competition. Today, we are happy to have with us two insightful guests. Our first is Neil Chilson, who is the Senior Research Fellow for Technology and Innovation at the Charles Koch Institute. He is the former FTC Acting Chief Technologist. He holds a law degree from the George Washington University Law School, a master's degree in computer science from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and a bachelor's degree in computer science from Harding University. We're also pleased to welcome Charlotte Slayman, who is the Policy Counsel for Competition at Public Knowledge. She previously worked in the Anti-Competitive Practices Division of the Federal Trade Commission. Her JD is from the New York University School of Law, and her BA in Government is from the University of Virginia. If you'd like to learn more about Neil or Charlotte, please visit regproject.org, that's regproject.org, where we have listed their full bios. I will turn it over to Neil to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion between our speakers, we will go to audience Q&A. So audience members, please think of what you'd like to ask our speakers. Thank you both for joining us. Neil, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And it's great to be here on a Teleforum podcast, a Free Lunch podcast, and it's particularly great to be here with Charlotte. To talk about one of the hot topics of the day around big tech and antitrust. And I thought that, in my opening remarks, I think I'll just lay out what some of the big problems that people are concerned about in this space. And I'd love to hear that from, hear a response from Charlotte. And then I think we'll move in later into the discussion of what kind of fixes that people are suggesting and the various pros and cons of those solutions. But I expect this to be a pretty good back and forth, so we may jump around between those two topics. So to kick it off, I thought I'd just highlight what are the concerns that we're hearing about in this space. And a lot of it is driven by the size of tech companies and the various ways that they're affecting consumers' lives and the various news stories that are boiling around them. And some of the big concerns, I would say, are concerns that we often hear about in the antitrust space, concerns over market concentration. There's been some well-publicized research around the levels of concentration in a wide swath of industries across the marketplace, and there's been a robust debate about what those studies mean. There's been a lot of concern over the effect on competitors, especially smaller competitors. We've heard this raised in a number of forums with regards to all of the various big tech companies, whether it be smaller advertising platforms, whether it be people who market and sell things on an Amazon platform, competing with Amazon's house label products, whether it be Facebook acquiring companies that offer services that in some ways are similar to the services that Facebook offers already. So we've heard some concerns about market concentration generally and in the tech sphere specifically. we've heard a lot, and I already touched on this a little bit, concerns around vertical integration, where a company offers a platform, but then also sells products through that platform, or other types of vertical integration, where a company offers a service, but then also builds its own supply chain that provides the other business operations that are needed to provide that service, and may also sell to competitors as well. And so concerns around vertical integration, and then just big picture concerns over, there's a whole other things that aren't typically in the U.S. considered antitrust concerns, but which, because they involve these similar players, and they're brought up in the same discussion. And so these are concerns around political power, concerns over consumer privacy, concerns over speech and moderation on platforms, and concerns over the effects on elections or the effects on democracy more generally of the big tech platforms. And a lot of these concerns, the question is whether or not antitrust is the type of tool that we should be using to address these concerns, in addition to the more general, the more well-accepted dimensions of antitrust concerns around market power and manipulation. So a lot of people, the result of this is that a lot of people are saying that the current antitrust system is broken because of these concerns, and they're criticizing the current setup that we have, and they're offering lots of different solutions to try to solve this problem. Most prominently, Democratic presidential candidate and Senator Elizabeth Warren offered a pretty detailed policy response, which I know that Charlotte has written on, proposing various sets of actions that we might take in order to deal with some of these problems. And that started a debate around that particular proposal, but also there have been many other proposals with a wide range of sort of levels of disruption to the current antitrust system, as well as approaches that wouldn't be necessarily considered antitrust, but might be more traditional regulatory approaches to deal with some of these many various problems that people are pointing to related to big tech. So I think I'll stop there and ask Charlotte to react, to lay out how she sees the landscape, how people are identifying, what problems that she is hearing that people are identifying, and give her basic take on what is the problem in this that we're trying to solve with some of these tools.
Great. Thank you, Neil. And thank you so much to the Federalist Society for having me here today. I'm really excited to be a part of this discussion, and I'm really looking forward to all of your questions at the end. So I think Neil has done a good job of laying out some of the concerns that we have about sort of consolidation and corporate power in big tech today. So I'm particularly focused. I think big tech is a sort of vague term. I usually say digital platforms, but then no one knows what I mean. I'm particularly interested in sort of the power that platforms have when there are, usually these companies are characterized by network effects. A lot of times we're dealing with two-sided markets. This is where people on sort of both sides of the platform are using the platform to connect. So that's why we think of sort of Amazon as a great example. They've got the Amazon Marketplace where companies can come and sell their goods, and users can come and buy the goods. Google Search is another example. They sell advertising, and so this is an opportunity for advertisers to reach users and an opportunity for users to get access to information. So that's the sort of platform service that I'm particularly interested in, and they really vary widely. And I think there are a wide variety of concerns that folks have about what's happening with these companies today. But the sort of big ones that it boils down to for me are there's sort of a lock-in effect that users of the platforms sometimes experience. And this is in part because of how great the platforms are. It is an incredible, several different incredible technologies that these companies offer us. And historically, I think folks have been in agreement that it makes sense to take sort of as hands-off an approach as possible to these companies because the innovation was so great. But now we are seeing the real impact, as Neil mentioned, that these companies are able to have on our lives, and using that same sort of deregulatory perspective over them isn't really working anymore. So anyway, the key problem is this lock-in effect. You know, when there is a privacy problem at Facebook, for example, you see consumers frustrated, they want to leave, and they feel that they can't. I think a lot of that in Facebook's situation has to do with network effects. They want to still have access to their friends who are on the network. If they want to leave and go to a competitor to Facebook, they lose that network. There can be a different kind of lock-in effect if you think about sellers on an e-commerce platform like Amazon. I think they say a similar kind of thing. Sometimes there are choices that Amazon makes that they're frustrated by, or choices that Google Search makes that companies are frustrated by, but they feel that that's where all of the customers are, so they don't feel that they can leave. So there's that sort of lock-in effect. I think the other big concern is innovation, and that's a major goal of antitrust, is innovation. You want to have the possibility of new entry into a market to encourage the incumbent firms that have been around for a long time to innovate, and also because new entrants to a market sometimes will have a greater incentive to innovate. They are not benefiting from the status quo where the incumbent already has a lot of customers. So the incentive to innovate is often on these new entrants. And so it's really important that new entrants can thrive. And we have a situation today in platforms where new entrants are concerned and are worried about the power that platforms have over them. So one of the great things that platforms provide is this opportunity for small businesses to use the platform to reach their customers. But at the same time, as part of that, it means that these small businesses are relying on the platform to reach their customers. So that puts them in this position where the platform has significant power over them. You know, if the platform sees that a small business is might potentially in the future be a threat to them, they have a lot of tools at their disposal that they could use to shut them down. So I think that's another big concern for innovation, is this fear that platforms will discriminate unfairly against firms that, for whatever reason, they don't find beneficial. So those are sort of the two big concerns I think that folks have, is this lock-in issue and this sort of discrimination and the impacts that has on innovation. But I also want to address Neil's point towards the end about these sort of other issues that we don't traditionally think of as competition issues, political power, the impact on democracy, and privacy. And as he said, folks have been discussing whether this ought to be included in antitrust or not. I think in particular with these digital platforms, with the companies that we talk about with big tech, the impact that they can have on our democracy is significant. And I think it's right that antitrust does not really take that into account right now. But as, you know, I think that policymakers do need to take that into account. So if it's not antitrust, we need to find another way to sort of take that impact seriously. And political power, I think, historically was part of the purpose of antitrust. And that doesn't mean that it's something that, you know, the antitrust enforcement agencies should be including in their analysis today under current law. But I do think that part of the goals of the antitrust laws originally was that when corporations become very powerful, they do get this degree of political power. And that you know, just sort of trying to address consolidation, even using the traditional antitrust criteria, would have this added benefit of sort of keeping that political power in check. And so I think that is another thing that we need to take seriously, even if it's not going to, you know, be one of the sort of criteria for antitrust.
Great. That's great. And I think I would love to dig into in a little bit about what that criteria should be, because that is a big part of the proposals to fix things. But first, I thought I might respond a little bit to a couple things that Charlotte said and maybe prompt some more thoughts from her. You mentioned big concerns around lock-in effects where consumers feel like they want to leave something, but they can't. I was wondering how in the antitrust, antitrust law, how do we think about the difference between that and just traditional consumers saying, well, you know what, I don't love this. I don't love everything about this product, but I still find it beneficial to be participating in it. And so I've made that analysis and I've chosen to stick with this product, even if it's not everything that I want. How would we view that in an antitrust lens where there is where a company is doing something and we might try to assess whether or not consumers are just choosing to stick with the product rather than you know, even if it's not perfect. And then the second point I wanted to raise was when we're talking about innovation or power over emergent competitors, in a related way, Charlotte talked a lot about the benefits that these platforms can bring to small companies who could not otherwise reach a mass market. And so the platform provides a ton of value to them at some risk, right, of any time that you rely on another company to reach your customers, that brings all sorts of risks. Maybe the company's unreliable, or maybe the company, moves into your space as well. And so the question is, how do we think about that from an antitrust perspective? How do we identify when that's a normal part of the competitive process? Both the consumer choosing to stick with the platform even if it's not perfect, and the competitor sticking with the platform even if it's not perfect. How do we determine the result of normal competitive processes as compared to something that rises to the effect of this is bad for the competitive process? And how would we determine that in a court and be able to say, hey, this is the type of behavior that isn't positive, and this is the type of behavior that is, because that seems to be the big question. Are we going to stick with antitrust that has a standard that's focused on, for example, the current standard of consumer welfare? Does this practice make consumers better off, or does it harm the competitive process and therefore make consumers worse off? How would we assess those types of behaviors in that marketplace? And I'll just throw that back to Charlotte.
Okay, so I'm going to take the second question first, and I guess to summarize, it's so platform.
Thank you for summarizing. I know I was a bit rambly there.
So I'm going to try to anyway. Okay, so platforms have this sort of power over the companies that use them, but when does that sort of cross the line, and how should we think about that in antitrust? So. I think you're absolutely right. You know, these companies have chosen to enter this market where they rely on platforms. I think platform economists, and I would commend the listeners to read up, Susan Athey and David Evans have done some great work separately, not together, about sort of the economics of platforms. But I think the theory, you know, what they sort of teach in business school is if you are in a business where you are reliant on a platform, your biggest priority is to make a direct connection to your consumer so that you are as little reliant on the platform as possible, so that you can be less and less reliant on the platform. So I think that is sort of the goal that these companies that use the platforms have. And I think the question for me would be how possible is that under the rules that the platform has set. You know, one way that a company can make a direct connection with their customers is if they are getting access to the data that the customers are giving as part of the transaction. So are these platforms allowing that or are they blocking that? In the context of antitrust, I think you would want to look more about sort of what is the strategy behind choosing to prevent those companies from getting access to that data. There's just like a lot of factual analysis that would be required. So maybe this is sort of skipping ahead to the end, Neil, but my proposal actually is not that antitrust is going to be able to solve all of these problems. I definitely think that we are going to need new legislation. I think we're going to need a sort of new regulatory system to handle these problems that is focused on promoting competition. So that's sort of the context for how I'm discussing this, and I'd love to talk more about that later.
Sure.
But so that's sort of an example, this data situation. If a small company can get access to the data from their users instead of having to be intermediated by the platform, then they can start to build that independent relationship. They can start to take over more of the process of how they are working with the customers. You know, they could learn some of the techniques. You know, I think one example is connected home is becoming more and more of an important industry, in part because of the data that you can get access to when you do that. And so if you are a company that's reliant on a connected home platform, you could start to expand your business. I mean, this is one of the major ways that platform competition in theory is supposed to happen, is that a company can be competing on the platform and then slowly expand to more and more verticals to become a competitor to the platform. And that is not possible in something like Connected Home if you can't get access to the key data for providing those other services. So there could be an incentive to platforms to prevent the companies that are using them from getting access to that data that they, in a sense, are sort of co-creating with the user. It could be in the platform's best interest to keep that data from the smaller companies so that they cannot one day come up and become competitors. So I think we just need to really expand the economic learning of how platform competition works to try to identify what are the types of strategies that a platform might use to block smaller companies from being successful. And whether that fits in antitrust law as it is today, you know, if it doesn't, I think we're going to need a regulatory solution. And even if it does, that takes a long time. So we'll probably still need a regulatory solution because these markets move very quickly. And so the time that is lost where competition isn't happening is really important. And can you remind me, Neil, the first question?
It was related.
Sure to answer
it was
about that as well.
Yeah, it was related to the lock-in effect on consumers, where they might just be choosing to stick with the platform.
Yeah.
And maybe when you answer that, you could help. And sorry, I didn't mean to turn this into a question and answer. I hope you'll ask me some questions as well.
Okay.
Maybe when you address that, one thing I was thinking of when you were talking about the harm to the competitors, the smaller competitors on a platform, is that often the consumer may prefer to only interact with one party, and that might be the platform for lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that be, you know, maybe I only want to give my credit card information to Amazon. I don't want to give it to every random small company that happens to purchase something on Amazon. And I might do that for privacy. I might care about that for you know, convenience. But how, you know, you made a good case about the possible ways in which a small competitor could be harmed by the platform, you know, limiting access to data. But that may have, you know, benefits to the consumer if they limit access to that data. And how might we weigh those out, both in an antitrust fear, but I'm also, curious just from a policy point of view, should our goal be essentially consumers being, better off rather than worrying about whether small competitors are better off or not? And so maybe you could just address that as part of the talking about the lock-in effect for consumers and how they make those trade-offs.
Yeah, so I want to start by saying that I think consumers are better off when there is competition. And if we have a situation where competition cannot happen, I think that is not going to lead to good outcomes for consumers. But I think you're absolutely right that consumers are concerned about privacy. And I think you've hit on a really important point. I think that comprehensive privacy legislation is going to be really important for competition as well. If people are deterred from using a better service because they don't have any reason to believe, and I think this is accurate, they don't have any reason to believe that their data is going to be safe, then I think that's a problem for all of us. So I'm hopeful that we will have strong privacy legislation at the federal level soon, and I think that would be very pro-competitive for this industry.
I'm happy to move on to, some other proposed solutions. I've been making you do all the work here, I'd love to dig into maybe some of the ideas. I was trying to aim at this a little bit. One of the big proposals is currently under antitrust law, and to put it in a little bit of historical context, I think you were right in pointing out that early on antitrust law, part of the concern was political. That people wanted the government to be able to push back against these companies that were perceived to be very both economically and politically powerful, and so antitrust was sort of born of that. And the standards that we were given early, 100 plus years ago, were very general in many cases, and gave a lot of leeway to antitrust enforcers to bring cases against companies that just at least nominally seemed to be creating problems for competitors. And that was often how the tool was used. The great example, and there's a great paper by John Nectarline and Tim Miras that talks about the AMP grocery chain, which was one of the first supermarkets in the country and reached a huge amount of efficiencies and price benefits to consumers by building a supply chain that sort of its own supply chain and that was more efficient. And that was a big concern to many of the smaller, mom and pop, say, or smaller local grocery stores who didn't have those logistical systems and thus were charging higher prices. And essentially, the court in that case didn't look really at how consumers were affected by it. They focused primarily on how competitors were affected by it. And there's language in that decision that essentially says, even though consumers were paying less, this was bad and it was anti-competitive because small competitors were harmed. Fast forward a little while, the consensus today is not the same as it was under the antitrust regime in AMP. The general consensus is that the focus of competitive harms, that we determine whether or not something harms the competitive process by whether or not it harms consumer welfare at the end of the day. And that can, that definition is often centered around price. And some of the critics of the consumer welfare standard say that is the only factor that consumer welfare standard really assesses. But I do think there's a pretty strong argument and a lot of evidence that the consumer welfare standard is more flexible than just price and has been used in lots of different ways. And so one of the big challenges is whether or not the consumer welfare standard, the way that we do antitrust law today, is appropriate. And I'd be very curious on your thoughts about, you've said that you don't think antitrust law can fix a bunch of the concerns that people have raised so far. I'm curious about your thoughts about the consumer welfare standard. How useful is it? And how do you assess the critiques that it needs to change, or that we need antitrust to do something different than it has done in the recent past?
Yeah, so I think also the name, the consumer welfare standard, leads to some confusion. And even I think the way that you've described it is a little different from how I would describe it, although I absolutely agree that it is more flexible than only price. But I would go farther than that. It is also not only about consumers. So the consumer welfare standard, I think, is intended to include not just price, but also quality, also innovation and consumer choice. There are already sort of multiple goals of the consumer welfare standard. But it is also not only about end consumers. It is also about the impact on suppliers. It is also about the impact on, business buyers. It can even be about the impact on labor, since that is an input in many industries. So I think we should not lose sight of that. I think in practice, it has become too focused on price. But, we sort of talk about the reasons for that. I think it's easier with the kind of complex econometric equations that we like to rely on, or that judges like to rely on. It's sort of easier to do that with price. And it's a little harder when the main avenue of competition is quality. So that can make it a little more difficult in these platform industries where usually the price is zero. Antitrust attorneys understand that competition is happening over quality. Competition may be happening over sort of data use and other avenues that aren't as much about price. But it's just a little bit harder to put those into a quantifiable economic analysis, and so we have sort of relied more on price. But I don't think that's the intention of the law, and it doesn't have to be that way. But of course, we are always taught, I remember this probably also from law school, but definitely from the FTC, that we are not about competitors, but about competition. But I think at the same time, we are not just about consumers, but about competition. So we need to keep all of that in mind and not get too sort of tunnel vision on consumer prices.
Yeah, sure. And I think thanks for adding some nuance to my definition. I often think of the other dimensions in which you were talking about as proxies at the end of the goal, as proxies. So like when we're concerned about the effect on labor or the effect on suppliers, that what we're primarily concerned about is not the effect directly on them, but on the indirect effect that, for example, reducing labor's ability to seek a different job, for example, would affect the end result of consumer welfare. And so I think that's kind of how I interpret it. And I think you're right that we often look for proxies such as price for that consumer welfare that are easier to measure. And I think that happens in the other dimensions that you're talking about as well. We might look at labor effects, but ultimately the goal is to ensure that whatever the practice that we're reviewing, that it's not making consumers worse off in the end. And I take your point that consumer can be defined a bit more broadly than just the guy who buys the product at the end of the process. But I think the key philosophical goal is that we have this one dimension on which we're trying to make, trying to ensure that companies aren't harming competition, rather than trying to mix in a bunch of other contrasting, conflicting approaches around you know, whether or not, you know, employment affects to the extent that they, you know, making trade-offs between those and whether or not something would make consumers better off. And antitrust kind of got away from that. And with some benefits to both the coherence of the law and to the ability of the law to resist political influence. And we're hearing a very different sort of drumbeat now, and I wonder if you might talk a little bit about that, around the need for antitrust to be more political, to take into account a lot of aspects that we might typically consider to be regulatory concerns, where we might have Congress pass a law to deal with a concern. And instead, the idea is, well, antitrust is a big, powerful tool, so shouldn't we be using that tool to try to achieve these goals? You know, that raises a bunch of concerns to me. It, you know, antitrust is a big, powerful tool, and when you unleash that sort of tool in a way that's unbounded, I think it's important to consider not just whether or not the politician that you agree with holding that tool, but think hard about what the world might look like if a politician you don't agree with is holding that tool, and what might be the effects on both the rule of law, but then on the particular political outcomes that you want, and how democratic is it for us to be making these types of important policy choices through enforcement actions driven by a single, you know, in many cases, a single head of DOJ, or, you know, in the FTC's account, it'd be, you know, five commissioners. Is that the right way to be making these complicated policy trade-offs rather than, you know, having a more cabined antitrust approach that focuses exclusively on competitive effects and the effect on the competitive process? That wasn't really a question, so you're free to say whatever you want.
Thank you, Neil. Well, I mean, you're certainly right that antitrust is a big stick, but I also think regulation and legislation are a big stick. And there are very real problems here that we need to find a way to address. And I think it has, you know, during the same period when antitrust has been sort of becoming more narrow since sort of the height at the A&P period that you talk about, during that same period, it's also been a deregulatory period. And so I think what we are facing now is a situation where there is a lot that is falling through the cracks that, you know, in the past might have been caught by antitrust, or in the past might have been caught by regulation. And people are noticing the impacts of that on their lives, and they're not happy, which makes perfect sense. So, you know, we are looking around for solutions, and my opinion is that we are going to need to improve all of these things. We're going to need to improve antitrust law. We're going to need to increase enforcement under the current law, but at the same time, we need to work on improving antitrust law. But that we are also going to need new legislation and regulation. I just think there's a very large problem here, and I don't think folks are wrong to talk about expanding antitrust to deal with it. I think it sounds like you may agree. I think regulation is really going to be where the meat of the progress is made here. But I completely understand where that perspective is coming from. And I will say, I mean, antitrust already does deal with multiple goals. So it's not completely out of left field to say that it could have additional goals. But that's not where I would focus my, you know, if I was wielding the wand, that's not where I would focus my changes to antitrust law. But I see where that's coming from.
Yeah. Well, we haven't talked much about the sort of some of the proposals that are out there.
The
Elizabeth Warren proposal is framed up in the discussion, the summary. There's a bunch of other proposals. We sort of have touched a little bit on whether or not getting rid of the consumer welfare standard and moving back towards something that looks more just at the size of firms and their market shares rather than the effect on consumers is the right approach. And I think it sounds like, well, I'm certainly against that. It sounds like you might be somewhat skeptical of that as effective. I'm not sure you seem to understand the motivation of it, but maybe skeptical of the effectiveness as compared to regulation.
So one more thing I want to say about that is it does have the benefit. I mean, you were talking about sort of how democratic is this system. It does have the benefit of being more simple so that people can really understand and see what's going on. But I do think this is an area where we need sort of that complexity that comes with regulatory experts.
So I don't know if you want to dig into the Warren proposal, if you want to talk about some of the other proposals
out
there. I would like to leave some time for people to ask questions, but we have some time.
Yes.
And so, so if you want to dig into the Warren proposal, I know you wrote a little bit about it. I'd love to hear anything.
Great. So I want to start by just sort of explaining my understanding of the proposal. I think there have been a lot of hot takes about this proposal that it can sort of get lost what the details were. So there's really two main components, I think, to the proposal. And the first one is new rules that would be in the form of legislation, and she hasn't specified. So I want to start by saying it's a very detailed proposal for a presidential policy proposal. I think in the past we've sort of had a knee-jerk reaction to presidential campaign proposals of saying, like, we need more details. She's given us a lot of detail, so I really appreciate that. But it is not, a legislative draft. So, of course, there are, you know, more things that I think would be worked out in the future. But the main meat of the proposal, I think, is this vertical integration limits. So she's proposing new legislation that would say, so Neil explained a little bit about vertical integration in the beginning, but what Warren is particularly interested in is when a platform, and the example she often uses is Amazon. A company owns the platform, and then they, at the same time, own a company that is competing on the platform. So Amazon has their marketplace, and then they also have Amazon as a retailer, and then they also have Amazon Basics, which is, I guess, a manufacturer. And so they are competing against other retailers on the Amazon marketplace. And her proposal would make that illegal. So she has said Amazon would have to spin off their Basics program so that, when we are shopping on Amazon, I always am buying the, phone charger or whatever from Amazon Basics. That would have to be a separate company from the platform. And I think her big concern there is sort of what I was talking about before, that in when you have a situation where the same company owns sort of the playing field and then is also competing on the playing field, there can be an incentive to sort of favor your own products. So what's hard about this is that we don't, at least in the public, have the information to know whether Amazon is actually doing this or not. And I think they have been very clear publicly that they are not doing this. So that's, sort of an area for further discussion is which are the companies to whom this should apply? What are going to be sort of the rules? I mean, I would hope that there's, a regulatory system in place to analyze what are the situations under which we want to be exercising this vertical integration prohibition. So that's sort of more detail that we would get if it actually became a real legislative proposal.
Sure.
So then the other big component is that she wants to nominate leaders of the Department of Justice Antitrust Division and the Federal Trade Commission who would vigorously enforce current antitrust laws. And in particular, she wants to nominate people who will try to unwind past anti-competitive mergers. And I think this is really interesting. There haven't been a lot of cases of this, but it has happened, where the antitrust agencies will unwind a merger that has previously, not often we say previously been approved, but I think it's important to note that the antitrust agencies do not approve mergers. They just have an opportunity to block mergers, and they may or may not block them. Her proposal is that they should, under existing law, try to bring cases to unwind some of these past mergers, and she lays out specifically some mergers that she has in mind. So those are the two main components.
Yeah. So one of the things, I may have been one of those people that did a hot take based on, so her initial Medium post is, as you said, it's more detailed than the average candidate's, but it's certainly not a draft legislation.
Exactly.
And it has a lot of rhetoric in it that is, it's hard to know exactly what she means by it. Other than, I mean, big picture, what you can take away from it is that she is worried about the big tech companies and she wants to do something. So, you know, part of my concern around the proposal as written in the Medium post and also covered in some of the press is that she is very careful not to focus on whether or not consumers are worse off because of these companies. All of her analysis is around whether or not competing companies are suffering under or have the potential to suffer from, for example, Amazon's approach. And to me, that's an interesting case when you're trying to persuade the public to do something, to not point out to them where they're being harmed by the practices. I think most of us are used to, you know, store brands. When I go into Walmart or a CVS, I'm used to seeing right next to Oil of Olay face lotion, the CVS brand, right? That tries to basically say I'm the same thing as that, but I'm half the price. And consumers are really used to that sort of home label version. And often I think those labels exist because they've found a market with consumers who are more price conscious. And so I don't really see with her first concern around spinning off integrated companies, I don't see a difference between what the risk that Amazon might have around that space and the risk that you know, Walmart might have around those space. And when you compare the sort of relative amounts of the retail markets that those two are, you know, Amazon is, they're a big chunk of online retail for sure, but they're like 5% of all retail in the US. And so I just don't see a principled distinction between Amazon's use of house labels and, you know, Walmart's or CVS's use of house labels. And I don't see any more risk in Amazon doing it than those other ones. So that was one of the things that came to my mind in when I read her proposal. On the unwinding of post-merger.
Can I respond to that part first? So I think there's two important distinctions, and I do think one is market power, and it sort of depends. Like if we were going to bring an antitrust case, we would have to show whether the market is e-commerce or retail more broadly. But I think when you are passing a law, you could say that the market that's important to us, to Congress, is e-commerce. So that's one of the benefits of not doing this through antitrust is we can set that.
Totally agree that the legislators are not bound to make these sensible decisions.
Right. But the other important distinction is the marketplace, right? So Amazon is not just a retailer. And I think this isn't clear to a lot of consumers, so it's sort of worth going into. When you go to Amazon, you are sometimes buying from Amazon as a retailer, but sometimes you are buying from other retailers that are selling through the Amazon marketplace. When you go to Walmart, you're just buying from Walmart. And Walmart.com, I believe, does actually have a marketplace where they allow retailers to sell. And so I think that they would probably also be subject to Warren's proposal just with regards to that online marketplace, not with regards to their retail stores. So if you go to CVS, it's different.
It's my understanding that actually many of the retail stores offer, you know, they sell shelf space, they sell priority end cap markets. They have all sorts of deals that are very complicated with the people who are selling through their stores about placement of products in the store. And so in that sense, I still think that they are selling something that's quite similar. They're doing something that's quite similar to what Amazon does in many cases. I think much more so than people give the big box retailers credit for. They are doing the same sorts of sophisticated placement and marketing inside the store. And they're doing that in partnership with the other merchants who are selling through their store. And so I honestly don't think it's as simple as you're buying from Walmart in many of these cases. You're often buying from a manufacturer of a product who has a deal with Walmart that allows them to sell products through their physical platform of the retail store. And so, I think there may be a lot more nuance in the retail store business than I think most people are aware of.
Neil and Charlotte, this is Nate.
Yes.
Let me just interject quickly because we're getting close to our hour, and I'd like to squeeze in an audience question or two.
Of course.
Check the lines to see. Obviously, we're going to have to book you guys for another hour or two to finish this discussion just between the two of you. But let's go to audience questions now. Let's quickly go to the first question.
It's been great listening to both of you, and it's been a very kind of generalist conversation. I think we'd all agree here that like the potential regulatory solution for something like Facebook looks a lot different than something like Amazon. You know, you're talking two massively different beasts. I took about 15 minutes worth of notes, but I know there's other callers, so I'm gonna short it down. So, you know, the initial thing. So I work in content control in tech, and you know, obviously competition is a big deal. My thing is that a lot of the innovation happening these days in especially things like machine learning, artificial intelligence, or emerging technologies are being set up for acquisition by these companies.
Yep.
You know, that's where the innovation is happening. And my big worry is that, you know, if we start using the big stick, it won't help competition in that realm. It will actually harm competition because, you know, you can't, even if we broke up Facebook into, or any of these large companies into 50 billion different parts, at the end of the day, the majority of competition is coming from smaller, nimble companies who are setting up to develop these technologies, and then they develop them for acquisition. And so that's my first kind of question is, you know, we can talk about the consumer benefit, you know, we've had that discussion, but you know, if we want to talk about technological benefit or advancement of technology, you know, we really have to consider the current system of startups being developed for acquisition. The other point I wanted to make is that, you know, Amazon Basics is not one manufacturer, and I agree with Neil that, you know, it is very similar to a house label. These are coming from multiple manufacturers, and they essentially bid for, to use the grocery store analogy, shelf space. And so, you know, I agree with Neil on that point. You know, as far as Facebook goes, political influence and privacy and all that, I mean, these are huge issues, but it seems like the regulatory system is so far behind the kind of social understanding of these systems. And so if I had to phrase two questions, it would be, you know, what does a new system look like that takes into account, you know, companies developing emerging technologies for acquisition? And then is regulation, this is a big one, is regulation possible to deal with something like political influence in the modern era? Thank you so much.
Great questions. I think I was the last person talking before the questions. So Charlotte, I'm happy to let you take a crack. And I know we're running close on time, so I might just
Those are big questions to answer so briefly. But I think you've hit on a really important problem that small startups are being sort of targeted at acquisition. And I think that really limits the type of innovation that is happening. We would like to see more disruptive innovation You know, the way that innovation, I think, ought to happen in these industries is that there's a new product that sort of overtakes and makes the old product, you know, irrelevant. And instead, the type of innovation that we're seeing is sort of small and on the margins and slight additional features to an existing platform. So I think you've hit on a real problem there. And then I do think regulation is possible in this area, and I really think it is the best way to address a fast-moving industry. You know, legislating to deal with every new thing is really difficult. It takes a really long time, and antitrust cases also take a very long time. And when we try to improve the law by bringing antitrust cases, which the FTC has done, I think the pay for delay example is a great one. You know, they sort of saw this problem in the world. And unfortunately, I don't have time to get into the whole details of what pay for delay was, but they saw this problem and they, over the course of, I think, 10 years, brought a lot of different cases. It was a lot of resources and they were able to improve the law a bit there. But I think you really need a regulatory system where you can do rulemaking and you have experts in this industry, because it is a complex industry and lots of different solutions are going to be needed. I think regulation is the very best way to deal with it. I know that's not going to be popular on this podcast, but that's my opinion.
And I'll quickly address the two questions as well. It's a great point that innovators often are – entrepreneurs are often very good at trying out lots of new ideas and failing fast, and they are less good – and I think we have some great examples in current tech companies – they sometimes can be less good at running a business, right? And so I do think that we need to have a lot of concern about how changes to antitrust law or the use of antitrust law might discourage people who are incentivized to innovate by the idea of being acquired and having somebody else then take the innovation that they've market tested and run it and turn it into a successful product. So I totally agree with that concern there. As far as regulatory possibilities, I mean, I think we can look at history and see the challenges that come with regulating, with passing complicated laws to govern technology. And if you want to see a sector that that is wildly different, takes a very different approach, and is in many ways innovative, but faces big challenges because the regulation that's passed is just out of date and doesn't match, just look at the telecom industry. And I think that the FCC's approach to very detailed expert rules, it's even harder with tech that moves fast for the regulator to be able to see into the future and adopt a framework that stays constant over time, and that allows the type of innovation that we've seen in the internet space, in contrast to, for example, the wireline telephone space, where the service that you get from your telephone looks very, very similar to what it looked like 30 years ago, because there is a regulatory regime in place that keeps it that way. And I think I'll just end there because I think we're close to out of time.
Let me just ask, Neil and Charlotte, would you have time to squeeze in one quick last question?
Yes.
Happy to, yeah.
All right, let's try to squeeze
actually,
in.
Actually, no, I have another call. I'm sorry. I do have to run.
Okay, unfortunately, we will have to leave it there for next time. But on behalf of the RTP, I want to thank Neil and Charlotte for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.